John Ramirez is a retired GS-15 rank CIA officer who served within the agency from 1984 to 2009. Serving within the Directorate of Science and Technology, the Directorate of Intelligence, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. In this exclusive interview, Mr. Ramirez will be presenting for the first time publicly his own presentation on UAP data collection within the United States intelligence community, a presentation that aims to, amongst other things, advise members of the UFO community as to the best approaches for accurate Freedom of Information Act or FOIA requests in order to obtain actionable intelligence on UAP data from various US intelligence agencies. Please remember to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to stay updated with all of my content. And if you want to support Project Unity and gain access to a dedicated Discord server of researchers on these fascinating topics, you can support Project Unity through Patreon. A link to the Project Unity Patreon can be found in the description box below. And so without further delay, I hope you enjoy this conversation and presentation with myself and John Ramirez.
Everyone in the government seems to be tripping over themselves trying to join the conversation, so to speak. Everyone wants to say, yeah, we've also collected, you know, data, and here's our data. But I really don't know. It feels like something is happening, but I don't know what that something is. And the fact that the CIA allowed me to say what I did, I was really surprised. So, and I got more to say. There's a few slides I'm going to expand on for a future presentation. I'm trying my darnest to try to get redacted, and I haven't succeeded. So there's a few slides there about the McMinnville UFO and the reality of... I would say hybridization that I thought would get redacted, but it didn't. And that's the word that Louis Elizondo can't say that everyone in the Pentagon is expecting him to say someday, is that we're all hybrids.
When you say that Lou can't say that, is that actually a...
It's a schedule.
Right, okay.
It's a schedule. I think the biggest takeaway for folks to understand is that things are happening on a, it's not a disclosure, it's a scheduled dissemination. And so certain things have to be set up before other things can be revealed. I think the kicker would be this James Webb Space Telescope. Oh, yeah? I think it's going to look at something and it's going to be so phenomenal that the government would have no choice but to say, oh, look at that, we need to go look at it, even though they know what it is.
Oh, okay. So you're saying that it could be the case that they're setting up this telescope with the prior knowledge that they're going to reveal something.
They need to look at someplace. Yeah.
That's
in space. And then there will be some kind of reveal there. And it's interesting that, you know, the Navy has taken a lead role in this and not the Air Force.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've talked about that a bit. I mean, it doesn't necessarily surprise me that you know, a group like the Air Force that's got such a controversial legacy history with the UFO issue would be reluctant to speak. Although the brain of the US Air Force, which is the National Air and Space Intelligence Center, has now got itself involved within the handling of information through the UAP task force. So there is that nascent.
Yeah, they're giving him that job. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where the job started, and that's where it should always be.
you think that's a good thing? Because I've asked a few people about this, you know, whether or not they feel that it's just a natural development, it's a good thing that NASIC is now in this position, or is this Project Blue Book-esque Air Force cover-up style thing coming up through NASIC? I mean, how do you feel about them being involved right now?
The fact of that everyone knows that's where it's going to go, that's quite a bit of difference than before. So like in Blue Book, it was more like, we know what's going on, but we don't want anyone else to know what's going on. And please come up with some reasons why they shouldn't think what they saw is what they saw. You know, that was more a cover up. And I think NASIC is more part of this controlled dissemination that will eventually come out.
Yeah.
I don't think they can bury it anymore because it's already out.
No, I think any sort of conversations around swamp gas and temperature inversion
would not be taken
very lightly at this point. Yeah. Are you optimistic about the direction of the modern UAP or UFO discussion within mainstream context? So in terms of governmental and academic and media engagement, does it make you optimistic about where we might go?
I think, the government's more than willing to say that the craft are real.
Mm-hmm.
The government doesn't want to say is who's driving the craft. And so that's still like very, very quiet of who's driving the craft. And the Air Force, their exploitation of that type of technology just made a mess of things. Because when people see triangular craft and whatnot, and they're not like flying in space, they're flying in our atmosphere. It sort of points to the fact that, you know, we know what the triangles are. And we want people to think they're seeing UFOs because then they won't know exactly what they're seeing. But the presence of orbs really threw everything at a higher pitch because they couldn't explain the orbs. And they said, okay, these aren't the saucers. These aren't your grandfather's saucers, you know. These orbs are different, and that's what really got everyone excited. Is the presence of these orbs that were detected, and so that's where most of the focus is on now. Are these orbs?
Well, that interests me because obviously my primary experiences that kind of catalyzed and threw me into doing these types of conversations were my own experiences, which I'm assuming you probably do know about, with orange orbs of light.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm very, very curious. And I find it interesting that that's the top level of interest with the phenomenon. But at the same time, like you said, it's not your grandfather's saucer. This is a more immaterial, it's an energetic form of some degree. And that throws out the quite easy to digest spaceship with some aliens inside it. You know, this is something else. I mean, I think Lou Elizondo has postulated that they could be some sort of, drone, you know, hyper advanced drone technology of some form that they're coming down and doing surveillance. I have no idea what I saw. So I'm full of questions when it comes to orbs.
Yeah.
And I know you have your own experience with that. Maybe we could get into that at some point after the presentation, because I know that you've had some experience throughout your career with actually encountering some of these orbs.
Childhood, yes.
and childhood, of course. Yeah.
And they are orange.
Yes, they are. I mean, that's the thing. They seem to come in a multitude of colors, but I've only ever witnessed these orange orbs.
Yeah. My wife has seen orange orbs here recently.
Wow.
And I've seen orange orbs and also a white orb. But Arizona is just full of, like, I tell people, if you've never seen one, come to Arizona.
Arizona, yeah.
Yeah, put your lawn chair out and just look up at the sky for a few minutes and you'll see something. It is like something about Arizona
going on. Yeah, that's interesting. Now, before we start the presentation, a quick disclaimer for those of you who will be listening to this via Spotify or any other audio platform. This interview is centered around the breakdown of a PowerPoint presentation, which we're going to be including on screen throughout the conversation. And so it is recommended that you watch this interview through YouTube so that you have a visual understanding of what's being discussed. I will also be including a download link in the description box for anyone who wants a copy of this presentation. So you can always download it and go through it whilst listening. So, John, what inspired you to create this presentation titled Navigating the U.S. Intelligence Community for Ufologists?
Well, I recognize that the FOIAs were primarily directed at CIA. And CIA's part of the intelligence community is not as expansive as people would think, at least not since the other intelligence agencies were created. And so CIA's purview into UAPs started to shrink because there were other agencies looking at imagery. Of course, everyone knows NSA collects signals. And as far as the UAP impact on military, on our hardware. That's all in DIA's basket. So by directing FOIA straight at CIA and saying, do you have any pictures of anything? Or what do you know about this? The only thing you're going to get are historical records and not anything current, because we don't do current things in this field as to the point that people think we do, but we are still involved in it. So I wanted to let people know that there are more agencies than just CIA. And of course, Louis put DIA on the map and Snowden put NSA on the map. So, I mean, there's more than just CIA, and there's many, many other places that might have this type of information. So navigating is more about like where to go to get information in an FOIA format, and how to create an FOIA, and how to tailor it so that you'll get the proper response. It's so important to not ask for everything, but if you have a particular event in mind, kind of narrow it down to a region or event by date and time. So also, I wanted to bring out the sort of like an outline of how a UAP would be handled today. Now that we have these intelligence agencies and we have these sensors, how would we handle an appearance of an orb? And so I went through a hypothetical case, and I had to call it hypothetical. But it's, as we now know, there are orbs. But what happened before ALSAP? You know, a lot of folks think that, you know, it's ALSAP and orbs. But it was an ongoing process to get to ALSAP. And the fact that the intelligence community is not just like civilians, there's also military, and there's separate laws governing how civilian intelligence agencies might collect against an orb versus how a military agency might collect against the orb. So that's what I wanted to do, and also bring out a story, a narrative of what I think might have happened back in 47. And I'm not saying that this is what happened. I'm saying that I myself needed to sort it out for my own mind, because I'm an experiencer as well as an intelligence officer. And so looking at it that way, I just wanted to like connect the dots for myself. And for using the puzzle metaphor, I have the corners of the puzzle, but I'd never seen the picture in the box. So I kind of know, okay, these are the corners, and I have a pile of pieces. And I kind of know where the pieces go, but not all of them fit right. So how can I make all of the pieces fit right to attach to the corners? And then maybe I can see the picture on the box. I think others in the government have the picture in the box, but they're not sharing you anything. And others who claim to have pieces, they're throwing pieces out. And a lot of researchers, a lot of enthusiasts are putting the pieces together wrong. And whether it's intended that way or just playing mischief, I'm not sure. There's a lot of information out there that doesn't make sense. And any intelligence officer can look at a document and tell you this is not a real document and point out the reasons why. That's what I bring to the table. I would like to help people understand what's real and what might not be real, and with the reasons why it might not be real, to unpack things, as I call it, as I hear information. And I'll give you an example, the Bob Fish emails. When I read through the emails, I saw where there were glaring errors in what Bob Fish said. Not to say that it isn't a credible source.
Can you just expand on that for anyone that might not know what these are?
Okay, I think Bob Fish wrote to Podesta, who was Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, thinking that Hillary would win the election and become the next president, and he wanted to let Podesta know that since he has stated that they would like to open up the UFO files, he wanted to contribute his experience with what some of those files might contain. And so he apparently had a source, another person who was, of all things, an e-linter like myself, an electronic intelligence person. And so he was like relating things kind of secondhand. Based on what the way I read it, because I could have put in more detail in what Bob Fish revealed. But he was on the right track, and it's just that little things were like not quite Not quite correct. And in fact, the correct unpacking of it is even more profound than what he said. So that's the Bob Fish story, and it went to UFO Joe Merger. So he had the emails and contacted him directly. But yeah, I can unpack that even more profoundly than what Bob Fish revealed. So things like that I could do.
Yeah, I think, well, this is why I said that I think it's going to be a very useful tool for people who are trying to increase the veracity, accuracy, and scope of their research, especially when it comes to Freedom of Information Act requests to different agencies. I think that this is going to be a tool that can be utilized. Obviously, you've got this background, and you're using your intelligence background and your abilities to craft this presentation. So I think that people are certainly going to find some benefit from it. So I think the best thing to do here is to probably let you take the lead on this. After all, it's your presentation, and then once the presentation is concluded, we can cap it off with a discussion at the end, because I'll most likely be writing down some questions as I listen. So maybe we can do a little Q&A session at the end or something like that.
Sure.
All right. Well, the stage is yours, John. So whenever you're ready, if you want to get the screen sharing up, and whenever you're ready.
Okay, so we're at the title slide, and as we said before, it's more of an overview of what America's intelligence agencies do, but with a focus on UFO, UAP investigations by the US government. This is a little bit about me. GS-15, retired. I retired in 2009. In the 25 years, I started in the Directorate of Science and Technology in the SIGINT field and the Director of Intelligence in the Weapons Intelligence Analysis field. Toward the end of my career, I was at the ODNI National Counterproliferation Center and then ended my career back at CIA. This is a very important slide because what this slide says is nothing in this presentation contains classified information and can be shared or published. So that's why I'm sharing it with everyone who is watching today. And they don't endorse what I say, and they don't even admit that anything I say is true or false. So it gives the government some leeway in kind of distancing themselves from what I might say, but this is very standard for anyone at CIA writing a book or a memoir or even a slide presentation like this. And they did not in any way tailor my presentation. They received it cold, they looked at it, analyzed it. I believe they sent it further up into government since it relates to UFOs and UAPs. And there was nothing there that was classified anywhere in up and down the government's chain. And here's where we're going to go. These are meant to be modules. I can pull out modules and build upon them or leave them all in. So these are the five modules that I have for the presentation. The first part is pretty much about the intelligence community. The second part is about things that you may have heard about the intelligence community, which are not true. And the third and fourth part are more in line with a examination of the history and also some personal speculations based on that history. And I ended up with some favorite resources that I go to find information. So here we go. There are 18 agencies in the US intelligence community. It used to be that the Director of Central Intelligence headed the 18, but also wore another hat, the Director of Central Intelligence Agency. So one person was managing back then it was 16. One person was managing 16 agencies as well as CIA. And it was thought that this conflict of interest may have had an impact on sharing intelligence across these agencies when it related to counterterrorism. The FBI was reluctant to share intelligence with CIA. CIA was reluctant to share intelligence with the FBI. So when the alleged hijackers came from overseas into the US, CIA dropped them, but didn't tell the FBI to pick them up. The FBI did pick them up, but didn't tell CIA that they were working on trying to find out what these guys were doing. So that break in the stovepiping of this information was very critical in what happened. Now, there's two sides to the intelligence community. There's the defense side and the civilian side, and there's two sets of laws. Title 10 refers to the Department of Defense, and Title 50 refers to the DNI and the civilian agencies within the DNI. And the overlap is very important because it kind of tells you why CIA was not involved in the UAP task force. If you look at the participants, the glaring conspicuous by absence was CIA. First, this is where the ODNI headquarters is located. It's called Liberty Crossing in Fairfax County. We call it LX. If I move my cursor here, you can see that sort of like an L, and there's the X. A trivia fact was that Lou Elizondo and I were both in this building at the same time, and I've never seen him, and I don't believe he's ever seen me. If we've met, it would have been in this hallway. It connects the two cafeterias together. But I didn't know who he was, and he didn't know who I was at all. And so it's a large enterprise, and that website there will tell you how this is supposed to work, the 18 agencies. So even though there are eight, okay, so these are the three mission areas in the ODNI: counterterrorism, counterproliferation, and counterintelligence. I was in the National Counterproliferation Center, but most people know the National Counterterrorism Center. They have the very large watch center that presidents go to make speeches. They also have the auditorium in the building where presidents make speeches. And so most people focus on the counterterrorism side of the ODNI, but it also includes counterproliferation and counterintelligence. So there are 18 members in the intelligence community, but five are more equal than others, let's say. And these are listed in the order that legislation founded them. CIA was founded in 1947. It's always the agency. And the IC, other members of the IC get annoyed that we always call ourselves the agency. And whereas the other agencies, you know, you say National Security Agency or National Reconnaissance Office. But we are the agency. We founded in 47. The fort is what we call the National Security Agency. And all of these agencies were founded due to some perception of a failure or the lack of some capability. 1952 was the middle of the Korean War. The Chinese entered the Korean War. It was believed that it was a failure of communications intelligence to be able to indicate and warn that the Chinese were going to enter the Korean War. So Congress set up a dedicated agency to collect signals, and that became the National Security Agencies, took out that function out of CIA, gave it to the NSA. During the 50s, there was a battle between the Air Force and the CIA as to who owned the skies in terms of reconnaissance. The CIA, of course, as you know, had the U-2 aircraft. The Air Force, particularly Strategic Air Command under Curtis LeMay, he was touting the B-66 bomber, converting that into an intelligence collecting craft. And there were fierce battles between the two. So Congress created the National Reconnaissance Office to blend in both U.S. Air Force equities and CIA equities in intelligence from the air and space, and also later was joined by the U.S. Navy. And they're called the Westfields or the Towers or Taj Mahal. The Taj Mahal because at one time the NRO had the most plush building in the intelligence community, if not the federal government. They had like some of the nicest facilities, but that's no longer true. And so now we have the DIA, were founded in 1961. So we don't call it the DIA, everyone calls it the DIAC. So if we're going to the DIA at Joint Base Bowling Anacostia, we don't say we're going to DIA, we say we're going to the DIAC, and everyone knows that's the DIA. So they are a military intelligence agency in the sense that they look at what other foreign governments are doing in terms of their military capabilities and assess what our hardware might stack up against their hardware. And so this was a result of another failure or a controversy in the government between the missile gap and the bomber gap. CIA and the Pentagon had fierce battles about who's ahead and who's behind. And because of that, Congress said, okay, we're going to have one agency to look at all things of military intelligence nature, and here's the DIA. The NGA, which in my opinion is the most important of the agencies in terms of UAP research, was actually part of CIA from a long time ago. It was called the National Photographic Interpretation Center, and later merged with Defense Mapping Agency. They called them the National Intelligence, the National Imagery and Mapping Agency. Now, General Schwarzkopf in the first Gulf War complained loudly, Congress heard, that the warfighter was not getting adequate imagery intelligence from the CIA, because they were holding on to it, and because of the classification level of the imagery being top secret SCI, most folks in the military on the ground, the warfighter, doesn't have that type of level to get that intelligence, and very few officers did. So Congress then took that function away, joined it with a defense function for mapping, and that eventually became the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, NGA, in 2003. And Crystal Palace is sort of like an informal name. If you saw their headquarters, you can see why they call it the Crystal Palace, and we'll look at that later. So of the four big agencies, they're functional mission managers for various intelligence disciplines. We have human intelligence at CIA, and that's well known because human intelligence is about recruiting spies from other countries to report what they're doing to us. They also have open source intelligence, or OSINT. That term has become very popular because OSINT is what most of you do in terms of collecting FOIA documents and looking at websites and trying to stitch together some truth as to what's going on based on open source. But CIA is the functional mission manager for that in the open source enterprise. As we said before, NSA has SIGINT. The director of NSA, internally we call it DERNSA, never the director of NSA. So internally we say DERNSA, and everyone knows that means the director. Now, measurement and signature intelligence became very popular most recently because they're the folks who specialized in the sensors that were collecting information at Skinwalker Ranch. And DIA has the functional mission manager responsibility for MASINT. And I've already mentioned NGA having geospatial intelligence. NRO is the mission enabler. They designed the sensor systems to collect against all of those other five intelligence disciplines from space. Now, there are also science and technology intelligence centers. You know the one at the bottom, NASIC, but let's go through all of them. First one on the list is MISIC, and they're in Huntsville, Alabama, and they're part of the DIA. In Huntsville, Alabama, Redstone Arsenal, as you know, is the location where the German rocket scientists went. Wernher von Braun had an office there with the Marshall Space Flight Center in the Redstone Arsenal. The National Ground Intelligence Center, we call it NGIC, their headquarters is in Charlottesville, Virginia. And of interest to some of you might be the fact that they are also the intelligence center for underground facilities. We all heard of ONI, but in the intelligence community, we know them as NMIC, the National Maritime Intelligence Center. They're located in Suitland, Maryland. And of interest to UAP researchers, they're the intelligence center with responsibility for undersea weapons and facilities. And so NASIC had many names over the years. During the Roswell era, it was called T2 Intelligence. And they changed names. Most people know them as FTD, Foreign Technology Division. And there were several names up to the National Air and Space Intelligence Center. We call it NASIC. And of course, they're located in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So let's look at a crop circle and let's apply those intelligence disciplines to investigating a crop circle. It's not a good idea just to send it to CIA because they wouldn't have pictures of the crop circle. It's another agency that has photos of crop circles if they exist in that agency. So it's better to tailor the FOIA to the agency responsible for those five intelligence disciplines. So what intelligence discipline would be most involved in the crop circle? And I think you already know that that would be NGA. In the fall of 2020, and the timing is very interesting because, as you know, the Department of Defense established the UAP Task Force in August of 2020 and released the report in June of 2020. So right in between that period, NGA thought it would be important to be able to exploit circles. And they wanted to know where all of the circles were, the physical features and geographically referenced activities on the Earth related to circles. And it says here that NGA seeks to know where all the circles in the world are and how big they are. I found that to be very interesting. And as far as the prize goes, it was awarded to, it was a public challenge to help NGA come up with algorithms to be able to detect circles on the ground. And you might think, well, gee, that's easy, just look for a circle. But a lot of the data the NGA collects from its sensors in space are scanned by artificial intelligence. It's not like the old days where you had film and you had someone, you know, looking through like binoculars on a light table and then scanning like real film across looking for things. That's not true anymore. It's all digital. And so the computer needs to find of items of interest or object of interest in that frame. And so circles presented a challenge to NGA, and they awarded a prize to a college student, I believe from Russia or a former Russian republic, who had the best solution to implement finding circles. So for a crop circle, you might want to have human-to-human contact, a person-to-person contact. You might want to interview eyewitnesses who may have seen the phenomenon being created. Also, it may have been a news item in the local television or print media, or people may have taken pictures of it and posted it to social media. So that's an OSINT type of intelligence gathering. Something I haven't heard too much about, but I find intriguing, is whether electromagnetic data may have emanated or still emanating from a crop circle. So who would have that information? It would be NSA. And of course, DIA, everyone knows now that they collect radiological, biochemical, spectral, sonic data, all of the above that doesn't fit human OSINT and SIGINT. And the DIA scientists, as we now know, were deployed to Skinwalker Ranch with their sensors, collecting for DIA MASINT. And NGA, of course, collects optical photography and electro-optical, and that includes infrared and ultraviolet. So sending FOI requests to these agencies tailored to what you want to know about that crop circle makes a lot more sense than just sending it to just one agency who may not have the purview to have these intelligence disciplines under its roof. And we talked a little about NGA, and I want to talk about commercial imagery because commercial imagery isn't utilized enough. Of course, we all use Google Maps, Google Earth. A lot of people don't know that Google Earth was originally a CIA application given to Google. It was called Earth Viewer. And so Google adapted it for its data. Now, Google does not own any satellites. The owner of Google satellites is Maxar Technologies, formerly it was called Digital Globe. They're located in Westminster, Colorado, near Boulder. The first two satellites were actually NRO satellites transferred to a commercial company. And it was an older satellite technology, so the quality of the image was nowhere near what we call national technical means imagery, but it was very, very good. Now, the government allows 25 centimeters per pixel. That is the pixel resolution from about 383 miles up. And that's pretty fascinating because what that means is if these commercial satellites wanted to do it, you can take a piece of paper, 9.8 by 9.8 inches or 25 centimeters per side, and you can lay them all out and put objects on them that covers up the paper. And from 383 feet, they can measure those objects. And that's quite the resolution up there. But usually they use 30 centimeter per pixel resolution because that's the limit of what the commercial satellite companies are launching at this time. There was a time when Maxar thought that they could do their own satellites and not rely on NRO for assistance. WorldView 4 was their standalone satellite with no government help, and that failed in orbit a few years after it was launched. So now they're going back with WorldView Legion in 2022 as they retire the older satellites. So we'll have six brand new satellites up in the 2020s, and likely they will have more NRO input to get those satellites working. Now, if you follow my cursor here, this is where you get the most detailed imagery. It's straight down. We call this nadir, from straight from the telescope right down to the Earth, straight perfect perpendicular to the Earth. That is the most useless imagery you can collect because it doesn't do any good to look at the roof of the building. You want to be able to measure the building, how high it is and how wide it is. So most of the time we look over here, not straight down. So we get an angle to whatever object we're looking at. Now out here, the imagery is very poor, and that's what you see on Google Earth. Very poor imagery, like a meter pixel resolution, whereas the actual capability is like a third of a meter, 30 centimeters. Now, wouldn't it be great to be able to get on Google Earth and be able to see what your house looks like right there and walk outside and see yourself waving at the satellite? Can't do that because what Google supplies is historic data, a snapshot in time that may have been taken a year ago, 6 months ago, maybe 2 years ago. It's going to be very dated imagery. Not so with NRO. For $300 million per year, you too can get 24/7 on-demand imagery from anywhere on Earth to monitor anything on Earth. But that's quite a lot of money to spend, but NRO does do that to augment its own satellites. And this is the Crystal Palace. This is the headquarters of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency in Springfield, Virginia. If you see pictures of it, and there are pictures inside released, it is tremendous building. It's very ornate inside. It's just amazing, this building that they built for NGA. It is the most important agency for UAP research because, as we know, the UAPs are like visual phenomena. They're lights, orbs, or craft. CIA doesn't take pictures, NSA doesn't take pictures, DIA doesn't take pictures. Interpol has satellites that take pictures, but where do those pictures go? They go to two NGA. And so it is the most likely place where you can actually maybe ask for a FOIA of collected and analyzed UFO or UAP data. But I looked at their FOIA requests for the last several years, and no one's ever asked them for anything related to UAPs. Well, hopefully that would change because they might be sitting on a lot of data. So let's look at a hypothetical case. Let's say an orb appears. And I use the STS-75 tether incident as just an exemplar of an unusual phenomenon in space. This is when they had a high energy tether and it broke, and it was powered up to such a level that it started to attract things in space. And these are some of the objects that it tracked. NASA always, okay, so you can't say these are weather balloons or temperature inversions or like swamp gas. So the newest thing from NASA is dust. Oh, it's a dust on the lens. So that's what they call this. It's kind of a dust particle material on the lens, something that flew off when the tether broke. It's just dust particles. But if you look at YouTube videos of this STS-75 incident on that date, you'll see that these disks are actually flying and maneuvering in a very intelligent way and changing shapes, blinking, I would say. It's really interesting to see. So let's see what might happen if we detected an orb in space. Well, so let's say that they discover light energy orbs under intelligent control, flying in formation with intent to go to a destination. The first thing that the imagery analyst would do is to rule out foreign military technology, confirm that it's not a advanced aircraft. And so they would ask weapons intelligence analysts like my shop, for example, which studied signals coming from these advanced aircraft of other countries to see, could it be that? Could it be like, for example, plasma stealth generators that were hooked up to the highest flying aircraft in the Russian inventory, the MiG-31, which can routinely fly between 85 to 100,000 feet and broke the altitude record at 123,000 feet. That's pretty high. Could it be that with a stealth plasma stealth generator? And no, it could not, because we know when they were in flight, and it did not conform to the events of these energy orbs. So we can rule that out as a cause of these orbs to be seen. So if it's not anything that is adversary technology, then we have to look on the ground and see if the software might have been malfunctioning. And the software was confirmed to be working within specifications. So, okay, what's next? Well, how about the spacecraft itself? How about the birds? We call spacecraft birds. How about the birds themselves? Are they working? And the birds were all functioning fine, according to NRO. NRO is responsible for the care and feeding of the birds in orbit. And everything checked out fine. So now we have an interesting situation here. So the NGA NRO reforms the DNI about what's going on up there. That's very unusual. And so the DNI decides we need to take a deeper dive into this. Let's examine what's going on here. So the DNI authorizes the establishment of a working group and also establishes a compartment to control dissemination as they study this. So the NGA, as lead agency, briefs the other agencies. Now, what do I mean by lead agency? The agency that owns the data is the agency that is the lead agency. They own the data because it's in their purview. NGA does imagery, and these were images. So as the lead agency, they're responsible than for conducting the working group. So they would brief CIA, NSA, DIA, maybe the Department of Energy. And within each of those agencies, they would establish an intra or internal agency working group and read in their own subject matter experts. And so now they gather all the subject matter experts together, along with contractors, and they're the usual contractors that you are aware of, like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon. These are the big four. They read in their scientists and engineers, and they all meet together. And they'll invite all the concerned parties together to study the phenomenon. And more collection might be tasked. Let's collect more data and see what's going on. The objective is to reach some kind of consensus and write a report for the DNI. They owe the report to the DNI since they brought it up to the DNI. So the DNI will get this report about this orb phenomenon happening. And by the way, NGA does not look at imagery over the Earth from NRO satellites. They're looking at imagery over the Earth in adversarial countries or foreign countries. So you can assume that this happened, let's say Russia, that these orbs appeared over Russian airspace. So the DNI briefs the president and offers decision levers. It's important to understand that the intelligence community never, ever makes policy. Only the president makes policy. And so they offer policy recommendations to the president, but it's based on data and informed by analysis. So decision lever one, I threw three of them together, three that made sense. Well, first is to observe, but continue active collection and analysis. This is a very passive stance. Just keep watching and see what happens. The second is to engage the phenomenon in some way, but don't threaten it. That is, let's fly something toward it or do something perhaps to attract its attention, but don't make it feel like it's in danger. We're just trying to see what reaction might come by engaging this phenomenon. And the third is very dangerous because it's not only engaging a phenomenon, but provoking a reaction and provoking in the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2022 that left the House and it's on its way to the Senate. There's a provision in there for this UAP office within the Pentagon to report on efforts to capture a UAP. When you tell the Department of Defense that you're interested in capturing a UAP and you want reports on progress for capturing a UAP, it gives the Department of Defense the idea that it's a kinetic response. And so that's decision number three, provoke a reaction. And I don't recommend shooting anything down. I think that's a bad decision. That's my opinion, but it's up to the policymakers to decide how they want to handle that part of the NDAA. Sue Gordon was the primary principal deputy director of DNI in 2020, and she resigned in 2020. And so she's asking, she knows that the intelligence community is great at collecting data. They collect more data than they know what to do with. NSA collects so much data that they had to build a giant data center in Utah in order to hold all the data they collect. So we're great at collecting data, but we're not so great at processing the data or analyzing data to solve problems. And that's true with the UAP side as well. It's easy to collect data, but it's not so easy to find out what's in the data and what does it mean. And that leads to the UAP Task Force report. So when I read the UAP Task Force preliminary assessment, I came up with a few pointers of how I interpreted it. It was very clear to me that military tactical sensors on board the F/A-18 Hornet were inadequate collectors of infrared data. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. As you saw, the engagement box was locked on to the UAPs in flight, right in the center. had they launched the missile, if the UAP didn't detect it and move out of the way, the missile would have been directed toward that engagement center. But that's all they did. It's not designed to like collect data and actually look at the infrared signature in a scientific way. It's designed to put a weapon onto a target based on a heat signature. So clearly that was inadequate. It was also made clear that the UAPs seem to have drawn, the national strategic sensors seem to have drawn the attention of the UAPs. And that's, to me, very fascinating, because amongst those national strategic sensors, as you know, are in-row imaging satellites. And if the UAPs were drawn to the national imagery satellites, there's a possibility that there could be like really good pictures of them, and pictures that, who knows, may have been, and video maybe, of these objects in flight in a very detailed fashion. So that's something that has not been released and probably will not be released, because it will give away the performance of the NRO platforms, which are very, very good. The other one, the X-37B, I thought would get redacted. I put it in there on the chance that it wouldn't, because I associated the X-37B craft with a strategic sensor. But it is like a mini space shuttle. It has a payload bay doors that open, but it's completely unmanned. There's no one flying it. It flies autonomously. But it seems like if the UAPs were interested in some of our most advanced sensors, XB-37B is an advanced sensor. It was also clear that we lacked collection assets on the ground where the UAPs were interested, like DOD facilities, Department of Energy facilities, intelligence community facilities, and NASA facilities. We don't have anything under the water or of persistence that could collect against anything like that. Persistence meaning it's there 24/7 collecting and sending information for analysis. But as part of the NDAA, FY 2022, it establishes an office within the Pentagon to do this 24/7. So that's a good thing. It's now not just a task force that's temporary, but a permanent office. And there's a reporting requirement of 180 days, not just one report, but every 180 days, we need a report, an update on what you're doing in terms of investigating and analyzing these UAPs. On the intelligence side, there are no national intelligence officers, NIOs for UAPs. They write the national intelligence estimate. The official analysis of a major issue is called a national intelligence estimate. There's no one covering that for UAPs. There are national intelligence officers for aviation, but I think UAPs might be more advanced than just covering aviation, for example. They need one for UAPs. And also, there's no subject matter experts covering UAPs as full-time analytic accounts. And what that means is there's no one there walking in the door and saying, your job is UAPs. That's all you do until the day you retire. There's no one like that. What happens is that in the course of doing our regular day-to-day analysis, which is, in my case, funded by the CIA program, CIAP, or at the DIA, the funding vehicle is called the General Defense Intelligence Program, or GDIP. It's just a big, huge pot of money, which is doled out by the respective financial officers, chief financial officers in each of these agencies, to the various groups and divisions within that agency to do certain things. So that's how you can do something within an intelligence agency without having a really big formal contract. It's part of your job, because that money also pays for your usual cast of contractors that are with you day in and day out, working side by side with you, as well as the government staff They're in there day in, day out. So unless you have to buy a building and buy a whole lot of equipment to put in that building, or deploy somewhere with that equipment and contractors deploying, you don't really need a special program budget. But you can carve it out of your existing budget because, for example, one of my jobs might have been to look at the ballistic missile defense system of Russia. And they may have radars that may have tracked UAPs. Do I need to have a budget to say, okay, I want to study these UAPs tracked by these Russian radars? No, I don't. So that's how that's done. And the intricacies of the budget will give you a headache. It's basically looking at yards of spreadsheets with tiny little numbers on them. So let's clear up some misconceptions here. So one of the things I've been upset at is when people claim to have worked in the intelligence community and just them opening their mouth and saying a few sentences, I know that they've never set foot in any intelligence agency. And they've had zero access. And for whatever reason, they portray themselves as intelligence officers, I don't know. It could be just notoriety or just speakers' fees at conferences, sell books, I don't know. But there's a few things that have happened that will prevent people like me from coming forward. Because when we have true facts, and those facts run up against one of these imposters saying that, you know, this isn't the way it happened, this guy is fake, we're the true guys, and the fake guys are saying we're fake, and all of a sudden the UFO community just comes down upon us because they believe this other guy more than they believe the true guy. And so that's happened where I've talked to my colleagues saying, why don't you come out like I'm doing? And they said, no way. I don't need to be insulted by these people who have no idea what they're talking about. And they're complete silence from those people. So I hope that what I'm doing will encourage them that they, if they have information, there's a way to present it for everyone that's legal, that's not a whistleblower, that's not leaking information. You don't want to attract the attention of counterintelligence people in the government by saying, I work for NSA and I have this information. That automatically, if you're a researcher receiving that information, nothing happens to you, Mr. or Ms. Researcher. Nothing happens to you. In the United States, possession of classified information, you can't be prosecuted for that. But the person who disseminates classified information can be prosecuted. So they look at you just to find out who you're talking to. So it's very dangerous to, unless you vet that person thoroughly, to gather information from outside sources, because two things are happening. Either they're truly leaking real information and they're doing it illegally, and the counterintelligence people are already onto them, because you, as a researcher, announced that I have this and here's a slide. They're on it right away. Secondly, it's a planned, truly planned disinformation. They just want to stir the waters up just to cause mischief. And there might be people who might misuse their position to cause mischief. So that's very important to consider. So we're going to look at MKUltra and what's an agent, above top secret, and cosmic. So MKUltra, everyone knows, people say mind control. It's actually behavioral modification. And mind control might be part of it. The MK part refers to an organization within CIA that existed during the Cold War. It's the Directorate of Plans. It's now called the Directorate of Operations. For a brief period of time, it's called the National Clandestine Service. But MK, when this program was running, was the Directorate of Plans. And specifically, the Technical Services Division within the Directorate of Plans, they ran the MK Ultra program. So the MK is a digraph. MK Ultra is what we know as a cryptonym for that program. So just having MK doesn't mean it has anything to do with behavioral modification. It just means it's a program in technical services division. So let's look at some of the history. Now, Project Chatter, 1947, interesting date. That's when they start exploring like mind control behavioral modification. And it's my personal speculation that I'm not sure it's because the Russians were doing it in 1947. But it's interesting that 47 was about the time that the Nazi scientists were, and actually the SS officers were working alongside the CIA. And could it be a telepathic encounter with a Roswell ET survivor? This is purely like speculation. But 47 is an interesting date. And the fact that it was first called Project Chatter was also interesting to me. Bluebird took over in 1950, Artichoke 51, and finally 53 was MK Ultra. And MK Search later was about creating a truth serum for interrogating captured Soviet spies. But going back to Ultra, it studied the feasibility of LSD. And it also had two goals. One's offensive, that is, can you manipulate a foreign leader? And defensive, can we prevent the use of this manipulation? Can we prevent it from having an effect on our own leaders? Now, the MK program, as MK Ultra ceased in the about 19 early 70s, 70 to thereabouts. The reason why you know anything about it is because it was revealed in the congressional investigations of CIA through the Church Committee, for example, was one. The Pike, I believe it was the Pike Commission as well. I might need correction on that. But the House and the Senate both investigated CIA, and the MK Ultra program was revealed. It would not have been revealed had it still been ongoing. So the program does not exist. However, it was a springboard to research paranormal metaphysics. Here's where the higher consciousness, remote viewing, psychoenergetics, telekinesis. Psychoenergetics is a catch-all phrase of being able to use your mind to expand, I would say, consciousness expansion, mind expansion. And all the effects that that might have. And along with that is spoon bending. It might interest you that there was a McDonnell Douglas executive in Huntington Beach, California, who invited CIA officers to bend spoons with him, and his name was Jack Houck. If you know Melinda Leslie, she talks very much about Jack Houck, and she does sponsor spoon bending parties as well, like Jack did. CIA officers were engaged in spoon bending to show you how serious we were about the paranormal and metaphysical aspects. So we know that MK Ultra is not operational today, but it's what is operational is even more interesting. The Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency is the IC version of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. I guess ours is called an activity. So what they're interested in, among many things that's related to MK Ultra, genome editing, for example, bioinformatics, biometrics, you can read it for yourself, DNA sequencing, brain activity, psychometrics. There's a website where you can explore more of what they're doing. And of interest to me was MIST, Molecular Information Storage, using DNA to store digital data. It's like William Gibson's Neuromancer, Johnny Mnemonic, coming to life. They're actually looking at the feasibility of DNA storing data. Let's look at some classifications. Above top secret, there's nothing really above top secret. It's all top secret. But there are compartments that are so narrow and so limited as to who's read into them that for all intents and purposes, they might as well be above top secret, because just having a top secret clearance does not necessarily qualify you to have that information. The one that I know related to Bob Fisher again is crypto. The crypto clearance, he claims to have had an above top secret clearance. What he really meant to say is, I had a top secret crypto clearance. Not many people have that. So that's an example of a so-called above top secret clearance. And if you look at FOIAs, you'll see a alphabet soup of markings. The most common one is SITK null form. Top secret is obvious. Special intelligence is communications intelligence, or SIGINT. Talent keyhole. Talent is ISR, is airborne sensors. Keyhole is space-based sensors. Now, keyhole, why keyhole? Well, the pattern that the satellites make over the Earth is very much like an hourglass, except the very top of that hourglass is very narrow ellipse, and the bottom of that hourglass is a much longer ellipse, slightly wider. So it reminded NRO of keyholes. So therefore, they named that program keyhole, that compartment keyhole. No foreign means no foreign, and that means not even to Five Eyes. The British UFO files were labeled UK only, no foreign, which means that the British did not share its files with the US government. It kept those files to itself until they were formally released. Let's look at Cosmic. I used to listen to Art Bell when he hosted Coast to Coast AM. And he would have like either call in, you know, when he had open lines, or somebody would call in as a guest claiming to have cosmic top secret clearance, and they know all about the UFO, what's going on behind the scenes, and here's my story because I had cosmic top secret. Cosmic does not, just because it's cosmic doesn't mean anything to do with UFOs or UAPs. Cosmic refers to a NATO classification. It's held within NATO only. The US IC does not use cosmic in anything. But if you look at NATO documents, if you FOIA those, and I don't think they have an FOIA process over in NATO, but they will have markings for cosmic. So what would it contain? It could contain things that are of vital interest to NATO, such as the movement of Russian leaders back in the Cold War. If the Russian leadership, the Communist Party leadership, headed for the bunkers, the tanks from the First Guards Army headed for fold a gap on the East German, West German border. So you got leadership getting out of town, tanks on the border, and you're seeing indications that the strategic rocket forces, their ICBMs, are getting ready to launch. That's cosmic importance, right? So that's the kind of thing got labeled cosmic. There are no agents at CIA, no NSA agents, NRO, DIA, NGA. We don't have agents. We have officers. Now, the FBI, the DEA, Secret Service, law enforcement components have agents, but not in the intelligence community. We're officers, and you can read the kind of officers we are, but we're never agents. So what's an agent? It's basically a foreign citizen from another country, a foreign national, citizen of another country, who for whatever reason, mostly we find that folks overseas want to help the United States for ideological purposes. And they are compensated monetarily or with goods and services. They have information to provide because they're in a position to provide that information to us, and we compensate them accordingly. Now, in police work, it's known as a CI, so a confidential informant. Anyone who is a police officer knows what a CI is. And a police officer knows that just because the CI is providing information to the police department, the CI is not a police officer. That's the closest analogy I can give to you about why there are no agents in those big five agencies. They're not intelligence officers. And anyone claiming to be an agent for one of the intelligence agencies I would label them outright imposters, because no self-respecting intelligence officer will call themselves an agent at all. It's just not done. Now let's look at the budget a little bit, and I discussed a little bit about the budget in terms of how to fund something without having a budget, because it comes out of your natural, your normal budget allocations going to your agency. There are two parts to the IC budget related to intelligence. One is called the NIP, the National Intelligence Program. The other is called the MIP, Military Intelligence Program. Now, DNI has recently released numbers about what those might be, and they're usually in the upper $85 to $90 billion per year, with the majority of that going toward the National Intelligence Program, not the military side, the national side. So that includes all of these civilian agencies. And so the compartmentation is so tight, they're competing for this money, that sometimes the compartmentation is used as a tool to protect exclusive turfs. You don't want someone to like trounce on your program. So you keep that program secret from another agency, because you don't want them involved for whatever reason. And even within the agency, one part of one agency may not know another part of the same agency is doing. That's just internal compartmentation. So as far as DIA is concerned, again, it's the General Defense Intelligence Program, GDIP. And within the GDIP, it gets broken down into various offices. Within CIA, it's the CIAP, the CIA program. NSA is the Consolidated Cryptologic Program. The National Geospatial Program. These are pockets or buckets of money. And inside their budgets, inside these pockets of money are budget line items called BLIs, budget line items. And next to the budget line item is a specific program that's addressing a specific need. You can actually, if you know where to look, download most of those programs. They're actually, most of them are not classified unless they are compartmented. And I found an example of an Air Force compartmented program, which is basically a blank sheet of paper, but it did have the top level number of how much they're spending in that program. So it's not completely like dark, I mean black, it's more like shades of gray. Now let's look at some Space Force stuff here. Russia has had Space Forces for a long time. It's part of the Russian Aerospace Forces. I found an interesting quote from a Russian officer, Sergei Brezhnoi, and he said, "We are unfortunately not ready to fight extraterrestrial civilizations." And he said that in all seriousness to a question posed by Russian media. And that's his position. So I should have sourced that one, but it's an interesting quote from someone in the Russian space infrastructure. Now, the Space Forces of Russia is tasked with monitoring, defending Russia from potential threats from space. The U.S. Space Force, pretty much the same kind of mission. It was the 18th member of the IC. Now, the U.S. Space Force, U.S. Space Command, is different from the U.S. Space Force. The command itself is known as a Unified Combatant Command. It's sort of like STRATCOM, Strategic Command, or CENTCOM, Central Command, or SOCOM, Southern Command, SOCOM, Special Operations Command. And so these commands are, in time of a conflict or an operation, have the authority to marshal in these other assets from these other services for that particular operation or that particular campaign. So SpaceCom, if they are activated, they can reach into the U.S. Space Force, they can reach into the space assets of the U.S. Navy, they can reach into other space assets, perhaps from the NRO, to do this. Now, wait a minute, you said NRO, isn't that an intelligence community civilian site? Well, the NSA, the DIA, The NGA and the NRO are not only civilian intelligence agencies, but they are also called combat support agencies. So the Secretary of Defense can marshal resources from these agencies for Department of Defense needs, because they're also combat support agencies. And there are certain, I've seen certain FOIAs released where they mention combat support agencies without really mentioning who those agencies are. So I just told you that it's those four agencies, and that are IC as well as military agencies. If they're supporting the Department of Defense, they're combat support agencies. NSA actually automatically broke it out as NSA and CSS. You might see CSS. The CSS part is the service cryptologic elements, the Central Security Service. These are the uniform members of the armed forces working at NSA. So that's the military side of NSA. Recently, I saw what purports to be a memorandum for the record from NRO, Central Security Services. And this is the memorandum for the record, allegedly, that was seen, which prompted Admiral Wilson to seek out more information about what's going on. I believe that's the way it was pitched. Correct me if I'm wrong. I might be wrong. But every time I see breakout or breakdown of the Wilson Davis notes, I always see this memo pop up. And that memo is very strange, because the addresses and the format is just totally strange. It doesn't look authentic. Now, the second page does look authentic. Why do I say that? Well, the persons mentioned on the second page actually appeared a long time ago with Art Bell, Coast to Coast AM, and mentioned the fact that they were going to Rachel, Nevada for this meeting. And so that part's real. And that happened a long time ago, but in the 90s, I guess, and it was dated 91. But the front part of that just didn't seem real, and the last paragraph didn't seem real. It doesn't seem like the kind of memo that would be written by the NRO from a non-existent Central Security Service, which should have been NSA. I'll just leave it at that, and I'd be happy to break that down for anybody. In fact, I can write a better memo that looks more real than that one. So here's some interesting revelations. So there's a phenomenon that occurred in the Soviet Union in the town of Petrozavodsk. Petrozavodsk, and I practiced that many times. I had 2 years of university Russian, and not very good student, I guess. But Petrozavodsk is a town in the Soviet Union where some dock workers saw a huge star-like ball of light flashing out of the dark sky. You can read it there. Spread out like a jellyfish, there's a picture of what it looked like. And it transformed into a shroud. They mentioned the colors that it looked like. It hovered over the city and sent out these numerous thin rays that you can see in the picture. There happened to be a TASS news agency reporter present, and I believe that may have been sourced to that news agency reporter. But it was seen by police officers, sailors, and an ambulance crew as eyewitnesses, as well as just normal everyday citizens. UPI then took that report and then published it here in the US. Russians report UFO like star over city. James Oberg is a NASA engineer, and he believed that the Petrozavodsk phenomenon was a test of the fractional orbital bombardment system. Well, the last time, now keep in mind that this happened in 1977. The last time the Soviet Union tested the FOBS or FOBS system was in 1971, 6 years prior. They abandoned the program. So you can't attribute what was seen here to this fractional orbital bombardment system. And it was studied by both Soviet scientists and the U.S. intelligence community. Both on the Soviet side and the U.S. side, we observed that there was an association with a certain missile, the SS-20 Sabre, which was an intermediate-range ballistic missile. This missile was designed for NATO, for NATO countries, that was designed to be deployed from the U.S. to strike targets in NATO as part of a European war, a nuclear war in NATO. It was not designed to reach across the ocean. It was not an ICBM. It could not have touched the U.S., but our allies would have been at risk. So every time the Russians, well, not every time, but many times when the Russians would test the SS-20 Sabre, here comes these domes of light also appearing. Now, NASIC's predecessor, FTD, they still stuck with the fact that, according to them, they thought the dome of light could be a missile countermeasure to obscure the numbers and trajectories of a Soviet nuclear missile attack. And the dome of light was used by Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. He actually used the phrase dome of light in a comment he made. That's how we got to know it as the dome of light. There are domes of light associated with more recent Russian missiles, the SS-25 and 27 Topol and Topol-M. They did use similar technology to evaluate missile countermeasures. But the phenomenon we know as Petrozavodsk was 8 years earlier than this first test launch of these missiles, and the SS-20 tests that occurred much earlier than these missiles. The Avangard, which is the Russian hypersonic glide vehicle, can fly at Mach 27, and it creates a kind of a plasma field around it. As it skirts the upper atmosphere, it carries up to a 2-megaton warhead. And so there was no such thing when the Petrozavodsk phenomenon occurred 4 decades earlier. If you viewed the Disclosure 2.0 gathering hosted by Mr. Greer, Dr. Greer, you have Timofey Egorov as one of the guests. And he said that the Petrozavodsk phenomenon is considered by Russia to be a true UAP. And just trivia, every December 26, and I just picked 2 dates, the Soviet Union and now Russia launches one of their major ballistic missiles, because no one's at home, that is home in the IC. We are all on vacation. We have a watch office probably, and we take care of it the next day. But they have a habit of launching missiles on December 26, the day after Christmas. Okay, so let's look at some DoD collection. ISR is Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance. There are several ISR craft. We're going to talk about Korbel Ball. And a pilot of the Korbel Ball, who's now a respected scholar of military aviation history, he gave a first-person account when he was the pilot or flying the Korbel Ball aircraft. He described a translucent milky white wall of light from the ground all the way up as far as you could see out of the cockpit window, and it radiated at 6,200 miles per hour outward. The Korbel Ball was designed to collect against Russian missile tests over Kamchatka. That's where it flies. And unfortunately, this is the plane that the Russians mistook when it shot down the Korean airliner. They thought they were going after Korbel Ball. Instead, they tragically shot down the Korean airliner. And another Bob Fish insert here, if I may. Bob Fish described the WC-135 as a weather plane. The WC-135 is not a weather plane. It is an ISR aircraft, and its job is to collect radionucleotides, nuclear particles suspended in the atmosphere, especially after a suspected nuclear test. In fact, they can still collect signatures from very old nuclear tests. You can still collect and determine what test it was from by breaking out the 18 components of radionucleotides that I can't pronounce it. Excuse me. But there are 18 components that they can collect, and the radionuclides, okay, 18 components that can tell you the mixture or the formula of that nuclear device, and they can then correlate it to something that occurred in the past. So they're still up there. Jean-Valo Melchizedek, a spiritual visionary, esoteric researcher, wrote a book in 2003 called Living in the Heart. And in it, he, page 50, he described an interesting conversation he had with a major in the Air Force. And the major in the Air Force, she said, the satellites could see a person's light body, that is the Merkaba field, as a person creates one through a meditative practice that Melchizedek teaches, in fact, that it creates so much energy in the person's light body that it can be seen in space. And she relates that the military was concerned about the creation of these light bodies. They didn't know what it was, but they now know it's part of a new consciousness that is unfolding on Earth at this time. I take Melchizedek's word at his word. I mean, I can't dispute something that I wasn't there to either say or not say that was true, but I take him at his word that this happened. So I think it's interesting that that the Air Force major said this to Melchizedek, and that's a person that I think people should interview and say exactly, you know, what else did the major tell you? There are two satellites that could do this, or the Defense Support Program satellites, a DSP, and the newer CBIRS, or Space-Based Infrared System. The DSP program is fading away. They're very old satellites, and they'll eventually be replaced by CBIRS as the constellation for launch detection. And the Russians also collected against the Dome of Lights using radars, or collected against UAPs, in fact, against radars. There was an interview with a Major General Alexeyev, and he said that the Soviet leadership actually ordered that certain devices, such as theodolites, which is basically just an instrumented telescope, a ranged instrumentation telescope, radar stations, be used to make contact. And the special military loads, these are the missile launches that carry not real warheads, but for lack of a better term, dummy warheads. And when the Russians would like launch one of these missiles with a dummy warhead, UAPs would show up. And these objects were recorded in instrumented data, because these radars are very good at detecting reentry vehicles from Russian missiles. So they're very good at looking at very fast, very small objects traveling at great speeds. And it's not classified to say that, for example, within the Russian capabilities also, there was a Mark 21 warhead that was associated with the Peacekeeper ICBM, which is no longer in service. And the Air Force released some information about it. The that warhead, the reentry vehicle, actually enters the atmosphere at 7.9 kilometers per second. And these radars have no trouble whatsoever tracking that. This is called the Neiman P. The left side is a transmitter, the right side is a receiver. And it was seen tracking anomalous phenomenon. In fact, the Russians say, we use this radar to track anomalous phenomenon. And they gave a lot of information about this. So I can say in general terms that this is an S-band radar. And S-band means two gigahertz to 4 gigahertz as radar frequencies. It works somewhere in that range of frequencies. There's another interesting radar, I believe, that is the AN-SPY-1 radar, the Aegis fire control radar, that also is an S-band radar. And so the Navy guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I'm accurate in saying that the SPY-1 radar on the USS Princeton operated in that frequency range that this Neiman P radar operated in. Now, Pechora ballistic missile early warning radar, these radars, it's a system of radars in the periphery of the Soviet Union, and they're there to look for ballistic missile launches from the U.S. A ballistic missile early warning, that's what it is. They also can detect satellites and compare the satellites to known ephemeris or known orbital paths of those satellites and identify them. Well, sometimes they collected things that, they could not identify, and they weren't missiles. They thought they were missiles, and they went to a high state of readiness, but they were not missiles, and they realized they were not missiles. And they continued to collect or detect certain types of objects like that, which were of interest to the Soviet leadership and the Russian leadership. And these radars operated in VHF. Let's say between 100 and 200 megahertz. That's what the best I can give you, because they're still, like, the exact frequencies are sensitive. How about China? This is another satellite, another slide that I thought would be redacted. It's not known, but discoverable, that the CIA had these collection sites in Iran. Even through the early periods of the Islamic Republic of Iran, these collection sites existed, but this, we lost them in 79 when Senator Gary Hart of Colorado, when he discovered that, you know, the government of Iran changed hands, he said, what about those CIA guys up there in the north? And he said that in a public way, and that embarrassed the Iranian government, and so we were kicked out of the country. Otherwise, we wouldn't. I think we would still have been fine there, but we got kicked out. And these collection facilities were there to collect intelligence on Soviet ICBM and missile tests from the mountains of northern Iran. So without them, where do we go? Well, we approach China. That's right, the People's Republic of China, our erstwhile adversary. We approached them with a proposal that we build these collection facilities on their territory, close enough to the Soviet border so that we get a good view of the missile launches and the missile impacts. And the Chinese agreed. I listed the sources of that information, the open sources of that information. It leaked fairly early, but we never acknowledged it. Now, we do now acknowledge that there was such a program where CIA technical officers from the Directorate of Science and Technology worked with the Chinese counterparts in the People's Liberation Army side by side, collecting against Russian missiles. And yours truly was one of those officers who worked with the Chinese directly. And spent a lot of time with the Chinese, even instructed the Chinese and how to analyze radar signals. It was all like authorized transfer of intelligence information because our target was the Soviet Union at that time, a bigger target. And so that program existed. And as far as I know, I don't know what the status of that program is, but there were sensors there that could have tracked the domes of light, and we briefed them on everything. They wanted to know everything, what we put in their country. We had to tell them, this is for this and that's for that. And so they knew about UAPs. They also had some indication, I believe, that these things were flying over their skies before we showed up. But nothing happens in China unless it's sanctioned by the Communist Party. You just cannot set up a UAP. You cannot have a MUFON in China unless the Communist Party says you can have a MUFON in China. So the UFO China Society was there to continue a scientific study. So they were informed that these are real and likely informed by us, the CIA. Now let's go to the Galactic Federation. And as you can see, I'm just jumping all over the place because I want to cover a lot of things. Eshed is not a NASA guy in Israel. A lot of folks thought he's this NASA guy, you know, like the NASA administrator of Israel. He wasn't. He's closer to being the counterpart to the director of NRO. And he, as you know, made these statements about the existence of a galactic federation and the fact that the US government knows about the existence of the galactic federation. And it was remote viewed January 13, 1988. And there's the URL if you want to pull that up. In the notes, it said that the interviewer facilitator was ED and the remote viewer was MR. So ED could have been Major Ed Dames. You know him from being a frequent guest on Coast to Coast AM. And MR is likely to have been the late Mel Riley. It's a fascinating report of being led into a chamber and having robed figures all around and having to lie down on a table to be examined. Did Roswell really happen? Well, this is Chase Brandon. He was a very senior officer in CIA. He was in the Director of Operations part of CIA, and that's publicly known. And he wrote a book called Crypto's Conundrum. And it's about his take on what happened at Roswell, but he went way back. He went back to the Atlantis. He traced it all the way through, through a character he called Chalmers, who had past lives in these various eras in Earth history, going back to the city of Atlantis. And there were some interesting details in here. Now, Chase originally went on Coast to Coast AM and he talked to the press about discovering this the files about Roswell. And he stated publicly on the air that there was a crash and there were bodies and there were not human bodies. So he stated that. And CIA heard that and said, Chase, you can't say that. So you need to do... You can't just go on the air and say that. So Chase said, I'm going to write a book. And so he wrote a book called Crypto's Conundrum. And his interview with these was about the same time the book was ready to be published. So does that. So did he just say that so that it gives more credence to his book? Or did he say something of significance in the book? Well, if you read the book, I mean, he says some things, many things of significance. For example, that these UFOs start from the water, fly out into the sky, and come back into the water, and that they're called USOs when they do that. And he wrote this back in 2012, so I found that to be interesting that he would say that. But he says that the cover-up was about hiding the fact that there were alien forces on the Earth, and that there were like ancestors of Atlantis on the Earth, and the government knows about this. That was his whole thing about the book. So read the book and just hold it lightly. You know, just hold it lightly. It is more of a science fiction book, but this guy was kind of informed. Now, for you guys who've seen Men in Black, the movie Men in Black with Tommy Lee Jones, what's the connection to Chase Brandon? They're first cousins. And Chase Brandon was the Hollywood liaison officer. He helped Hollywood with scripts of making it more realistic, of having the production crew and the actors to CIA headquarters to see CIA officers at work. So they're better informed about how to act like a CIA officer and sort of like have a more better story about how CIA really works. Robert Gates said that, hey, I have a respect for Chase and I'm not going to question what Chase says. He didn't say what Chase said was BS or wrong or he's crazy. He didn't say that. In fact, he said that he can't, you know, he's not going to say either way whether it's right or wrong that Chase may have made it up or not, but he has a lot of respect for him. So this pretty much shows that CIA doesn't think UFOs are fake, because on the CIA website, if you go to that URL, you'll see tips on how to investigate a UFO. And they use the Lonnie Zamora incident of April 24, 1964, as the exemplar. This is how you investigate a UFO. Nowhere on that page, if you read it yourself, do they say that UFOs are fake, that they're actually our aircraft, or that they're anything like swamp gas, weather balloons, all of the above. No, they say, this is how you investigate a UFO. And by the way, the Lonnie Zamora incident seemed to be a very credible incident. So you can go ahead and look at that, and that's a fun read. And then, of course, you have the former directors of the National Intelligence and Central Intelligence, that there are a lot more sightings than have been made public. And that's from an informed way of saying that there's a lot more sightings than the 143 plus balloon that were not made public. And of course, Ambassador Woolsey related the story of his pilot friend, his plane stopping at midair at 40,000 feet. And CIA Director Brennan went on to say that it's something that we don't understand, the type of phenomenon we don't understand, and it might be a different form of life. So now we come to personal speculations. This is the history part. Okay, paperclip. Used to be called Overcast and changed the name to Paperclip. Germany surrendered early May 45, we know that. But immediately thereafter, there was the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency started to operate to collect the Nazi archives and locate Nazi scientists. And who helped them? Well, it was the Nazi party officials and SS officers. In fact, Waffen SS troops from the 15th, 19th, and 20th Waffen SS divisions from the Baltic states switched uniforms, wore American uniforms, and guarded their former masters, high officials in the Nazi party. And that is a true statement. So the first group of Nazi scientists arrived in the fall of 45, and there's the happy group photo of them at Fort Bliss in 46. So we have Paperclip running. We have JIOA running, and JIOA collecting all of this data about what's in the Nazi archives. Well, somewhere in there, Truman was briefed about the Nazi obsession with bloodlines and hybridization. They were really interested about this. So I had to speculate that the German scientists revealed the existence of a human hybrid breakaway civilization. That they revealed that they researched, trying to research reproducing advanced technology, hybrid advanced technology, and that they revealed their research into a superior civilization of ancient origin that's still on Earth. And off to the right side, you see the two vehicles there. The only industrial country with an industrial base that's viable after World War II is the United States. And supposing that there were some plans or blueprints or whatever you want to call them of these two top vehicles, that's up to speculation. I don't know. But the bottom one definitely was a vehicle. It was taken to RIPAT T2 Intelligence. And so the Horton 229 is an actual craft, and doesn't it look like some of our stealth craft today? So what was that organization running around the world trying to find evidence of the hybrid civilizations? It was the Deutsches Annenerbe. They investigate the supposed hidden occult origins of the German race. Occult does not mean demonic, it just means hidden. They wanted to link the German ancestry of the Aryan race to the inhabitants of Atlantis. And they believe that when Atlantis was destroyed, that the survivors of Atlantis spread across the earth to the New World, for example. They went everywhere looking for the survivors of Atlantis. They went, strangely enough, to the Antarctica, looking for evidence, artifacts that they existed. Did they find them? I don't know. But they supported these expeditions. They were into these occult practices, psychic phenomenon, and unfortunately tragically conducted these human genetic experiments in the concentration camps of trying to experiment with DNA. And here's a picture of them with Tibetan dignitaries in Lhasa in 38. So how are you going to hide all of this from becoming public? Well, one way is to create an intelligence agency. And at that time, in January of 46, now mind you, May of 45, we have Nazi SS officers assisting the U.S. government with finding information that's in the Nazi archives. Some of that information was regard to their research into Atlantean civilizations, into breakaway civilizations, advanced human hybrids. And how do you hide that? Well, you need an intelligence organization called the Central Intelligence Group, which was founded in January of 46, the beginning of the year in 46. And its purpose was to hide the association of the U.S. government and these former Nazi officers. And they classified the exploitation of advanced technology gleaned from the Nazi archives. And this creation of this National Intelligence Authority and this Central Intelligence Group was the birth of the modern national security state. Whereas Paperclip brought over 1,600 Nazis, 1,000 of those Nazis actually worked for CIG and later CIA. They were spies for the CIA. And we sent them back into Europe to spy against the Russians. They were more easily able to assimilate into East European countries. And of course, the famous one was General Reinhard Gehlen. He was sent back to help establish the West German Intelligence Service, the BND. Now let's go up to Roswell. Now with all that history behind, now you know that, okay, the CIA, the CIG, was working with Nazis, and that part of that work was recovering artifacts, recovering technology that the Nazis were working on, and now we have Roswell. Not to say that Roswell was German technology, not to say that, but let's look at it. So there was an eyewitness account, Mr. and Mrs. Wilmot. What they described on July the 2nd looked very much like what we would call UAP. It's an object that glowed from the inside, not as if it was lit from the outside, traveling very fast and very high with no sound. Now that happened on July the 2nd. On July the 8th, comes the newspaper article. The 2nd and 8th, it was a long period of time. Now, I don't believe that the recovery of these objects occurred after July the 8th. I believe the recovery of the objects happened prior to July the 8th. And I cannot prove that because I have not gone into the CIG FOIA. I don't know if there is a CIG FOIA. Maybe it's held by the CIA. Maybe that was the information that Chase Brandon found in the historical intelligence collection. But going from there, there was some foreknowledge, I believe, that there was such a craft that the Nazis were interested in. And who flew the craft? I don't know. They weren't human, I don't believe. I have not seen the files that Chase Brandon saw. But could have been the Atlantean craft that was flown with hybrids on board. I don't know. That's just pure speculation on my part. I'm just trying to connect dots, and some dots sort of like our outliers and can't be connected. But this is the way I'm trying to sort it in my own mind. You absolutely do not have to believe anything I say. You can just toss it away. So finally, we come to later on in July, a law created the CIA and what was called the National Military Establishment. The Department of Defense wasn't named until August the 10th, 49. between right after Roswell through August of 49, it was the National Military Establishment that was created. And what's of interest was the fiscal year in the modern Roswell era between July 1st, 47 and July 30, 48. Fiscal years that year where the government gets funded. Right now it's October 1st to September 30th that the government is supposed to be funded if Congress is able to put a bill in time for the president's signature before October 1st. I don't know when was the last time that happened, but be that as it may, let's go back to May of 48 when they had the Armed Services Procurement Act. It provided defense agencies a means of non-competitive practices. Sole source defense contracts where the Pentagon would go to one person or a one contractor, one entity saying, you got the contract, we're not competing it. And it can hide the budget. This law allowed the government to hide the budget of these sole source contracts. And that greatly increased the power and influence of defense contractors. And that is the start, in May of 48, that birthed the modern military industrial complex. It did not start with Eisenhower giving that speech. He had to live with this as a reality that these contractors had so much power in the Department of Defense. And you probably heard the existence of the rogue programs. My argument is the programs aren't necessarily rogue. I don't believe that there are rogue programs. I do believe there are unacknowledged programs, but there are laws on the books like Title 10, Section 119, that allows these types of programs to exist out of sight, out of mind. And there's an executive order, 13526, recently, I think most recently updated by President Obama. I don't know if President Trump or President Biden had done anything with 13526, but this executive order, based on U.S. Code 10, Section 119, allows for carve-outs and unacknowledged SAPs that do not have to be reported. However, having said that, don't even think for a moment that no one knows what's in them, because in the House Armed House Appropriations Committee, there's a subcommittee that actually can look into these unacknowledged SAPs. And though they may be unacknowledged, they're going to be called something else as a cover name for something else. And that cover name is going to have a dollar figure behind it. So they're not truly unacknowledged in that sense. And believe it or not, the subcommittee members in the that particular appropriations committee are cleared at an extremely high level. They probably have more tickets or compartments than I had. I had 26 when I retired and signed off on all 26, read out. But they probably have as many as they need to do their job. And so who knows? It might be in there. Okay, now we're at McMinnville, Oregon case. Now, you're probably familiar with this particular craft with the conning tower on top. It appeared in Life magazine, July 26, 1950. It was the Trent's photographs that appeared. This case has never been successfully debunked. And if you want to read great analysis on this case, look at Richard Dolan's work. Richard Dolan's work on the McMinnville case is head and shoulders above anything I've ever read. Very impressive. And so look at that. It's never, ever been debunked, not even by the U.S. government. This has not been debunked. So let's fast forward a little bit and some background information. So we know that it was seen in McMinnville, Oregon. Now, on April 30th, 2005, a satellite on National Reconnaissance Office launch number 16, satellite payload was launched on a Titan IV-B. This was a ICBM missile that was converted for space launch. And in fact, during the Gemini program, the Titan was converted to launch Gemini astronauts. So here's the Titan IV-B launching the last one to carry a payload up into space. It was the 30th Titan 4B to carry anything up into space for the National Reconnaissance Office. So there's two Titan 4Bs left. One went to the National Museum of the Air Force at Wright Pat. That makes sense. It's the National Air Force Museum. You want one there. The other one went to, of all places, an obscure Air and Space Museum, Aviation and Space Museum, in McMinnville, Oregon. Think about that. Not the National Air and Space Museum, Washington, D.C. We have one here in Tucson, but no, it went to McMinnville, Oregon. And look at the launch logo. Now I'm going to do something here that I think I can do on the Mac. All right, here we have. My, what big feet you have. This isn't a gorilla. I call it Bigfoot. And what kind of bird is that? It's a pelican. Who is the pelican? I'll let you answer that for yourself. And then also, sorry for that, you also have palms, palm trees. And of course, you have the missile. And you have a bright sun, or is that an orb? I don't know. Let's just call it a sun for argument's sake. There's sun and a missile. Okay, Bigfoot, pelican, palm trees. And where's the palm trees come from? Well, have you ever heard of Palmdale, California? It's the home of the Skunk Works, Palmdale, California. I'm looking at this and I'm saying, my gosh, is this like a tease? Is this just coincidence? They put these objects, these two animals, and these and this palm trees here, or what are they trying to tell us? And the fact that there was a famous McMinnville, Oregon UFO case, and they took this logo, which was on the Titan IV, and the last two Titan IVs went to the place where they had this UFO incident. And look at that logo. I am developing this slide. I can expand on it in a very surprising way. CIA has a letter from me telling them, informing them how I'm going to expand this for a future presentation and describe more in detail of this particular case. Now, this is known as the infamous slide 54, because it's the 54th one in the deck. And I promise you, I know we went long, but we're almost done. This is called informed speculation. I think it's hidden history, but let's call it informed speculation. And I'll clue you in on why it's informed. So a lot of these inter-row launch mission patches, launch logos, tend to depict reptilians and occult figures having some kind of dominance over the Earth. It's very unusual that they would show that. So I speculated based on other things that I've learned, and I'll leave it at that, that we're reptilian beings able to manipulate primate DNA to accelerate human hybrids. Did that happen? And were some of those human hybrids people that in myth and legend we call Atlanteans? In fact, aren't we all human hybrids? After all, let us make man in our image, says Genesis. Why aren't we like apes? Why aren't we like the bonobo, the gorilla, the chimpanzee? That's better for speculation. But did they do this? And are the accelerated ones really the Atlanteans? Did they ordain this idea of kingship and priesthood through selected hybrid families? And were they able to establish aristocratic bloodlines? Bloodlines in aristocracy are so important back in ancient times. And hybrid families of power and wealth, did they establish that? And even today, are they exercising some kind of political power, economic control off the stage, or hidden social influence? And I'm just leaving that as it is. I'm just saying that it's informed because I wrote to CIA and said, here's why I know this. And CIA came back and said, well, we look forward to your presentation when you do this on these two slides. And I have a serial number for that particular submission, so I can refer to it when I do these two slides and expand it into a future presentation. Personally, I believe this is one of the core secrets. That's my personal opinion. Let's look at some of the logos, and I'll go through them real fast. NRL4, launch 4. Launches numerals are not necessary in the order the spacecraft was launched. So I'll just say that, but this is number 4. Number 6. Number 19. Number 32, the Eye of Horus. Number 35. And by the way, her name is Angelique. She was named by some folks in NRO. They said she's Angelique. I don't know where the Angelique name came from, but that's her name. And there's Angelique on an actual payload fairing for an NRO satellite. Anubis, god of the afterlife, Egyptian god of the afterlife, on NRL 38. That A stands for Atlas. AV is Atlas 5, number 23 in the launch sequence. United Launch Alliance, 45th Space Wing, and I don't remember what LR stood for. I'm sure there's people in the audience that would know that. There's Anubis, Egyptian god of the afterlife, on a NRO spacecraft that U.S. taxpayers paid for. And on the spacecraft itself, now I should say the previous one was a mission patch, as you can tell, something you would sew on a jacket. On the spacecraft itself, we have three-headed dragon. And if you notice that around this official little poster, the NRO put out, you have reptilian skin surrounding all of this. Reptilian skin in a circle for the O. And there's our three dragons on the Atlas V, which, by the way, the RD-180 rocket engines is thanks to the Russians. We launch spy satellites against Russia using rocket engines supplied by the Russians. And there's a constellation. I don't know if this is Draco, but if there's any amateur astronomers out there, that might be a clue hidden in plain sight. I don't know what constellation that is at all. That's 38. 39 is the octopus. And there's our octopus on a payload fairing. 49. Latin translates to the most important fall. You heard of fallen angels, and that fallen angels might have been the Atlanteans that were separated from the other humans because they were too far advanced and their civilization was destroyed, therefore fallen. I found that to be very intriguing. And Betty here, it's probably Betty Sapp. When this mission went up, Betty Sapp was slated, S-A-P-P, Betty Sapp, was slated to be the first woman director of the NRO. Most important fall. And here's another patch for this, or another logo. The devil you know. Vandenberg Air Force Base, the first Delta IV heavy launch, the rocket that actually launched it, from Space Launch Center number Space Launch Center number 6 at Vandenberg. Space Launch Control, maybe, number 6. The devil you know. Get your kicks on 66. And Green Door. Green Door assignments in the Air Force are black program assignments. And if you look at this patch, I don't know if it's a magician or an insect, but this patch is so intriguing because the more you look at it, you see more things into it. But I see two red eyes here, and I don't know. This looks like a Merlin, the magician hat. I don't know, but keep looking at it. And some people see insects. Some people see a magician with a Merlin the magician hat. This red spot here over the United States is the southwest of the United States. Okay, southwest United States. What black program would exist in a southwestern state, like in a desert? Leave it at that. But these black programs are called...
Looks like it's holding a dagger, the golden overlay with the...
Yes. Good, Jay. Dagger. I see that now. Thank you for that.
No problem.
And the U2 Dragon Lady. That's the nickname for the U2 that CIA gave her, the Dragon Lady. And that's it, really. There's the CIA reading room for UFOs. I recommend going there first because that's where all the UFO archives are located at. And if you see a link through a Google search and you click on the direct link, you just get to the front page of the reading room. You don't get into where the actual document is. I recommend doing a right mouse click, do a copy and paste, and paste it into a browser, and then go from there, and you'll get right to the article itself. And I use the Black Vault, that's a repository of FOIA. And I also like the War Zone because they tend to be well connected to Defense Department programs. And that is it. So I say embrace YA hold lightly as my way of saying I don't reject anything. Outright, just because I don't believe it, I don't reject it. As an analyst, I'm trained to analyze all source intelligence. So even if it's something that seems completely wild to me, I won't hold it tightly, and not in the sense that I'm going to believe it and it's going to be like part of my UFO conversation, but I do hold it lightly. And either I find it proven or disproven, and then if it's disproven, I can drop it. But I don't just because someone says something that I disagree with, I don't attack that person. I may not agree with that person, but I just take it as it's a data point for me, myself, to either research on my own to prove or disprove. And so with that, Jay, I turn it over back to you.
Wow, John, that was amazing. And I'm most impressed with the fact that you only cleared your throat once and took one sip of water during that entire presentation. I think I would have been clearing my throat and sipping away that entire time, but you did fantastic. And as I was saying at the beginning of this, I think that this presentation is going to serve, there's a multitude of different things that have been addressed throughout this, some really interesting little tidbits that I wasn't aware of, like the Chase Tommy Lee Jones cousin relation. I had no idea that that was a thing, but also just the fact that this is going to really help people in refining down the process of Freedom of Information Act requests, different agencies that you've gone through. And I think that that's going to have a lot of benefit for people. I have written down a few different questions. So if you're happy to kind of do a little Q&A now, just sure. Briefly, one thing I just wrote down near the beginning actually was, why is the CIA referred to as the agency?
Part of it is probably because we were the first. And if you look at the founding of the CIA, it was founded by very elite families in the United States who went to the right schools. Right. In fact, there's a movie called The Good Shepherd. And I suggest that if you want to look into the founding of the CIA and how these elite families got together to create this intelligence agency, that's a good movie to go to. And it shows some of the kind of attitudes that these families had, that they were like exalted above other families, that we are special, that we hold the United States. And there's a line in there we have the United States of America and the rest of you are just visiting. It's that type of attitude.
Right.
But they also give credit. I think you UK viewers might be interested that the CIA learned how to spy from the British intelligence.
Yeah, that
right. I mean, you guys had an intelligence service organized since Elizabethan times. Mm-hmm. And so we learned the British system of intelligence. OSS officers were trained in Canada by the British intelligence. I think it's called the SOE, was the organization in World War II that trained the OSS officers. And afterwards, we applied British tradecraft as to how we conduct business. But the secrecy around it, this cult of, I call it the cult of intelligence. In fact, there's a book written called The Cult of Intelligence. And all that surrounds the CIA of keeping things like, keep it dark and keep it hidden. I think that came mostly from the Nazi influence, the German influence of how we organize ourselves in that way, how we run counterintelligence. Counterintelligence being run against us, not against you. So if I came to you and said, hey, Jay, I got this top secret document. And then you say, hey, I have a source with a top secret document. It's not you that could get in trouble. It's me. And that's what counterintelligence is about. It's about stopping leaks of classified information from happening. And so any researcher that says, I got this from a trusted source in government, you've already been, you're a person of interest, not for any legal action, but because they want to know who that source was that gave you that. That source is in trouble. And if that source is still giving you classified information, either that source was turned or that source is a complete imposter giving you fake information. Believe me, these guys are good. These guys are good. Counterintelligence people are very, very good.
Yeah, this is an important thing to highlight because, a lot of researchers, myself included, have been approached by all sorts of, different people claiming intelligence backgrounds. And, speaking for myself as a 26-year-old young man from the UK with no intelligence background whatsoever, in terms of vetting sources, it's extremely difficult. I mean, I've been fortunate in, getting connected to, individuals like yourself and others who have a background and able to vet these people appropriately. So I think that, and I'm certainly not the only one out of the more modern UFO researchers who have, had sources come out of the woodworks and communicate with them. So it's definitely beneficial to have someone with your background providing that kind of advice, because it will just serve as a way to just more easily verify whether these people are legitimate or not. And it's no secret that there is absolutely disinformation being circulated amongst the UFO community. It's just sometimes hard to pin down whether or not it is or whether or not it isn't. I think that's always a struggle for researchers. So that's definitely going to be something that's going to be beneficial for people in the long run. Also, you mentioned the UK, and you're probably just going to cite the reasons you gave before, but I find it very frustrating that the UK's Ministry of Defence chooses to neglect this issue as non-essential to national security interests, when our closest ally, the United States of America, has at a governmental level started to engage openly on the potential national security risks posed by UAPs. Why do you think the UK is remaining silent on this, when we have also had our own similar incursions historically by UAP with ICBM stations and nuclear capable stations? Why do you think we're staying back on this?
Well, I was interested in what Baroness Goldie said in the Lord's Questions. And for our U.S. audience who don't know who Baroness Goldie is, she is the officially the Secretary of State for Defense, basically the Ministry of Defense. She heads that, and she did state in questions, this is when the other lords can ask her about the status of what Her Majesty's government might be doing on a certain particular issue. The UAPs came up a few days after, or maybe a week after, the report was released, the preliminary assessment was released in the U.S. And she said, well, not to worry, the UK is prepared to defend itself from any of these threats. So don't worry about it. We have it. We have it covered, but she didn't really say exactly why they dropped it. She said, we're not looking at it because it's not a threat to us. That's what I read. But if it was a threat to us, don't worry, we have it covered. Having said that, I think your UK audience knows that, you know, there's still like sightings from UK citizens.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I can't believe that the government is not interested in some way, shape or form. I don't know if they're like looking at open source, if people report it to the newspapers or something, that they say, okay, there's a case. No, let's look at that. They do it quietly, but I don't know. So that's up to speculation. Why? Unless they say, well, let's just let the Americans do all the heavy lifting and we'll follow up behind it. The Australians also, they're in that same mode of operation there.
Well, yeah, we share a close similarity with Australia, it would seem, in terms of handling this issue. And the thing is, for me, is, you know, in the US, we've got Navy pilots talking about, you know, frequent incursions into training ranges and you know, buzzing our aircraft. I can't imagine that a similar scenario isn't playing out within UK training scenarios that are handling, especially when it comes to like strategic nuclear assets or anything like that. I mean, this can't be a unique phenomenon to America only. So I don't imagine that the UK is dealing only with historical issues. I imagine there must be real-time issues that are occurring. They just don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jay. They don't want to talk about it. And you don't have an FOIA process in the UK. What you have is the OSA and for US citizens, the Official Secrets Acts are very draconian, very mm-hmm. draconian. And if the Home Secretary has her way, she wants to criminalize possession of classified materials, criminalize journalists from possessing it. And that's very dangerous for the UK researchers in this field. You don't want that to happen. That's very bad because it really suppresses everything. It puts you at jeopardy for possessing anything whatsoever. And we have reciprocal agreements between the two governments from going back toward back when the US and the UK worked together to crack the German Enigma code. Those agreements have existed, especially with NSA. And so we have extradition. So if I gave you something and I said, oh, I'm not going to run out of here and I'm going to hide out in the UK, that's the worst place to hide out because I'll be shipped right back. And so you don't want that to happen at all.
Freedom of press is alive and well in the UK.
As a US citizen, let me say this. I'll take ownership for this statement. If the UK had an FOIA, one of those FOIAs will go to a radar in a place called Fylingdales. Fylingdales. It's an RAF base there, and they have a nice radar that looks over the Arctic Circle. It's similar to the US PAVE PAWS radar, which we built to look at the Arctic Circle for occasions of an ICBM attack, for example. And that's what the UK version is there for as well. It's part of our mutual missile defense examination. And that's the radar. If there's anything flying out of the Arctic Circle, that's the radar that will see it. It has the power and the capability of seeing it. So that's my FOIA. I'll go there and say, what do you have? So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, like you said, we've been around for a long time and we have refined our secret keeping down to a fine art. So it's very difficult to break into the restrictions of the UK government when it comes to this. One thing that you brought up, which was really interesting, and I think it could yield some results, hopefully, if people engage FOIA requests, because as you said during the presentation, at least to your knowledge, this is not an agency that has had much attention by UFO researchers, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Now, would you say it's likely that this agency does have a portfolio on crop circles?
I have no idea. In fact, talking about FOIA, I assisted a group of independent researchers, the research team, on that specific issue. I help them craft an FOIA using language that NGA would know and identify, and ask if they had any fact of these crop circles. Do you have national technical means imagery? That means NRO imagery. Do you have commercial imagery of these vegetative patterns in agriculture areas of the United Kingdom, popularly known as crop circles? And that's the language I use. And other phenomena, by the way, I just put in other phenomena just to catch anything they have. Because the one thing about FOIAs is the people who deal with them literally. And they'll give you exactly what you ask for, or won't give you exactly what they ask for. No, they don't volunteer information.
No, yeah.
And I know that because I was one of the guys who was with the black pen redacting FOIA documents in areas that I had expertise in. And some of these radars that were seeing tracking objects that were not missiles or satellites. And somebody sent a FOIA request and they said, hey, you're the radar guy for this. Can we release this? And I went through it. And then basically I redact names, phone numbers, and office designators, office addresses. I keep intact the information if it does not reveal sources and methods. And then I let the FOIA office then lower the classification. I just mark the content. So I know what it's like to do the FOIA, and I know it's a very literal process. So you have to be careful what you ask for. If you ask for nothing, you'll get nothing. You have to ask for something that they have, that you think they have, and put it in the language they understand.
Yeah, well, again, like I said, hopefully this presentation will serve as a tool that can be utilized by people. I'm looking at you, John Greenwald. You know, I want to see some Freedom of Information Acts on these types of things through these different agencies that we haven't maybe engaged with as much. As a UK citizen, I just have to sit here with my hands tied behind my back. I can't send FOIA requests off. So, you know, yeah. It's up to you guys. Obviously, this is just speculation, but one of your decision levers in your hypothetical orb scenario was to engage and provoke a reaction from the phenomenon, which, as you justifiably said, is an unwise action. Do you think that kind of decision has been made before in relation to UFOs?
I don't know. I think if it was made, this is the advantage of not having any UFO UAP clearances. I have no SAPs. I have no clearances related to this, but I know there was a radar at White Sands Missile Range, and I know this radar was used for V2 testing, and it's also associated with a B-29 testing how accurate the bombers would drop a bomb from a B-29. So this radar is used for both purposes, just a tracking radar. It's a very good tracking radar. And it uses, and I'm going to get technical here, bear with me. It uses this device called a magnetron. It's the device that actually creates and generates the electromagnetic energy in a microwave range. And it operates at 3 gigahertz or 3 billion cycles per second. And that is in S-band. Remember I said 2 to 4 is S-band. So it's operating right smack in the middle of this band of frequencies, which also is the AN Spy 1 radar on the USS Princeton. It's also that Russian radar I talked about called the Neiman P. It's also an S-band radar, and so is this at White Sands. And so happens that Tesla once said that a magnetron can be used as an RF weapon.
Right.
And he said that, and I wish I can find that. I found it in part of my research, and for some reason I lost that reference. But Tesla said that a magnetron can be used as an RF weapon, and I believe he actually cited 3 gigahertz. The Japanese built a 3 gigahertz magnetron device, and there was a technology transfer to the German company Telefunken before the U.S. entry into World War II. 3 gigahertz magnetron. So that technology existed, and that 3 gigahertz magnetron was what generated the microwaves of these two radars at White Sands. And so if these radars were up and running in 1947, I don't know if that had any effect on the craft. I don't know if it attracted the craft. I have no idea. I'm just throwing things out, these loose ends that I have difficulty tying up.
Yeah, this is, well, there was the memo, wasn't there? There was the memorandum that was, I can't remember who wrote it, but I believe it's on the FBI's website, which is in relation to the Roswell incident, that actually mentions the engaging of those radio towers, or, you know, satellite, however they phrased it, that may have brought down this craft, right? So there's a potential that these magnetrons may have disengaged the UFO in the sky and caused the Roswell crash.
Yeah, these are dishes. Yeah. These are little radar dishes. And in fact, it was in a 1950s UFO movie where the army or whoever mounted these radar dishes and was knocking down flying saucers over Washington using these radar dishes. And that was one of the interesting movies of them showing, we know how to do this.
Wow, yeah, yeah. These... wink, wink, nod, nod. Yeah, we know how to do this. I believe Philip J. Corso, when, some people, don't believe his accounts, but I'm pretty sure it was Corso who, when he claimed to have actually seen one of these extraterrestrials in a craft, it said to him that they are requesting that they take the radars offline so that they can leave this area. And I think that's when he said, "What's in it for me?" And they said, "A whole new world if you can take it," or something along those lines.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So
they countered that quote.
People might fact check me. I know that there was something along those lines with Philip J. Corso. So maybe someone can comment below if I'm getting that wrong. Do you believe that the CIA and other agencies are still interested and engaged in studies of telekinesis and other effects of expanded states of consciousness?
I would say that if any of that is happening, it will be through the DNI, not the CIA, because the DNI has a mechanism, the IARPA. And I listed some of the interesting projects they've worked on. So I would say it's in there. I don't know where the Office of the Chief Scientist went. Before the Office of the Chief Scientist, it was called the Office of Research and Development. In Kit Green's time, he worked for the Office of Research and Development and the Director of Science and Technology. He retired the year after I joined. So he retired in 85. I was there in 84. But that later became the Office of the Chief Scientist. And the so-called weird desk is basically an entire office. It's not just one desk. It's everybody's desk in that office can be considered a weird desk. They just look at things that are highly unusual, that doesn't fit into a intelligence category. So that's where it comes in that, you know, like I was invited by Jack Houck to bend the spoons. And I regret to this day I didn't join the group to bend spoons. I think the other CIA officers I was with went there.
Have you ever attempted it yourself?
Yes, through Exo Metaverse, through Melinda Leslie up in Sedona. She works with Exo Metaverse occasionally to have these spoon bending parties online. So I was surprised I was able to do it. The Jack Houck story is interesting because I mentioned the radars that were the Soviets used or the Russians used to lure or attract UFOs. The contract was with McDonnell Douglas, and the program manager for that is Jack Houck.
Ah.
So there's that little linkage there.
That's interesting.
And he was very well connected. And that also goes to Jack Houck and John Alexander as well, Colonel Alexander,
right.
Dr. Alexander, I should say.
A man of many titles. Now, one other thing that I thought was really quite interesting, and you actually said yourself that someone needs to interview this person, so I'm going to be working on that. The can't remember their name now, but the author of the Living in the Heart book.
Junvalo Melchizedek.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to definitely have a look into that, because the statement regarding the Merkaba of light is just absolutely fascinating. So I would love to try and get that person on record to try and dig into what else they were told by was it a major?
A woman major of the U.S. Air Force.
Yeah,
with him.
Yeah,
and wow. the backstory on that is guess where I heard that? Inside the building, inside headquarters.
Oh no way. Okay, so that's definitely something that's made it around the coffee table a few times.
Yeah, and but it was more like, oh, did you hear that?